This is Brian Anderson, editor of City Journal. I'm here with Nicole Gelinas, Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow, City Journal contributing editor, and author of the brand new book, After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street and Washington, just out from Encounter Books, and described as an instant classic by the eminent financial historian John Steele Gordon. Nicole's book puts the financial crisis in the context of history so that we can understand that it was not unprecedented and indeed was inevitable. And she gives us straightforward, simple solutions on how to prevent a similar crisis in the future. Nicole, welcome.
Thank you, Brian.
In your book, you note that the credit crisis and resulting recession are the work of an invisible hand. Not the invisible hand of free markets, you say, but of an overwhelming government interference in those markets. The conventional wisdom is very different on this. It's that free markets have failed, precipitating the economic crisis and the subsequent government bailouts. How do the facts bear up against the conventional wisdom?
Well, free markets didn't fail, and this is a very important point because we really haven't had free financial markets for 25 years. What we've had is a government that has failed to understand its proper role in financial markets, in financial companies taking advantage of the government's failure here to make profits, as companies do. Companies were acting rationally in an irrational world. What happened starting 25 years ago is the government stopped allowing financial markets to discipline themselves. We first had our first too big to fail bank in 1984, a bank called Continental Illinois that was about to go under. The government decided that the failure of this bank, it was the eighth largest bank in the country, was just too much for the nation's economy and indeed the world's economy to bear. And so the government stepped in, bailed out the bank, made sure that its lenders didn't take any losses. And what that taught lenders to these big banks is that they never had to worry about their money. So we had, in essence, a debt crisis because the government had decided to subsidize bank debt with this guarantee, too big to fail, that if the banks got in trouble, this debt would be repaid. So we stopped having market discipline of financial markets. That was the first thing. And there were a few other ways in which we also stopped having market discipline of financial markets. Markets can't discipline themselves if that discipline will cause unacceptable damage to the economy. We learned this after the Great Depression when banks failed in droves. People panicked, took their money out of the banks. This was in one way good in that failed banks were going out of business, but in a larger way it was very bad for the economy because this panic pushed the money supply down. It pushed the economy into freefall, a freefall that was very difficult to get out of. Unfortunately, other things that we started doing in the 1980s made it difficult for the markets to discipline themselves, just as it was difficult in the 1930s. Things like removing limits on borrowing so that there would be way too much unpaid debt that the economy could not pay back if something went wrong. Removing requirements for financial instruments to trade on exchanges so nobody knew where the risk lied. In sum, financial markets knew that the government would not let financial companies fail because the cost would be too great to the economy.
Well, can we go back a little bit and talk some more about the 1930s rules, which you alluded to there? What were they exactly? How were they designed? And what can we learn concretely from that experience?
Sure. The best thing that FDR, who certainly did many things wrong in the Depression, the best legacy that he bequeathed to the financial markets and the economy was clear, simple, consistent rules to create a level playing field for financial markets and allow them to discipline themselves without causing undue harm to the economy. Now, FDR's financial policymakers understood you don't need geniuses to regulate financial markets. In fact, you don't want geniuses to regulate financial markets. You want people who understand that they can't predict every risk and every problem, and therefore you just have some basic, simple rules in place that mean when the unpredicted problem comes up, you have some insulation for the economy against total meltdown. And these were things like, you know, very elegant creations. The FDIC is the best example, where FDR understood that you could not have these banks fail, people panicking and taking their money out, but at the same time, you couldn't have bad banks bailed out by the government and staying in business and causing good banks to compete against bad banks, which is bad for the economy. So they devised a system where, yes, if a bank made terrible decisions, it would fail, but small depositors would get their money back. So this allowed for market discipline, but within a government framework that meant panic would not spread through the economy. Other things were things like borrowing limits on stocks. You know, before the Depression, people could borrow 85%, even more, against the value of their stocks. And so that meant when stock prices went down, there was all of this money that could not be repaid. And so they put in what's called margin requirements, essentially limits on borrowing where you can only borrow half the price of the stock. And then on the downside as well, just as you don't want too much borrowed money pushing up a bubble and having that debt not repaid when the bubble bursts, you also don't want people panicking on the downside and selling stocks down so that they reach the price of zero. So you had some rules to govern that as well. But the problem is, starting in the 1980s, we lost sight of the fact that these rules were necessary, and we allowed markets to escape these rules very gradually.
Well, could you say a little bit more about that? Because certainly the broad perception of the markets in the 80s was that there was some measure of deregulation that went on. But the financial industry is still heavily regulated in a variety of different ways. So it's hard for many people to see deregulation as the culprit here. And this is a different strain in your book, apart from the too big to fail argument. What else went on in the 80s that contributed to the current financial crisis?
Yes, and this relates to too big to fail, because everything that happened meant that the stakes for the economy of failure were so much higher that eventually failure just had to be avoided at all costs, which is not good for the economy. The problem is, it wasn't deregulation so much as it was that new financial firms and financial markets began to escape the existing regulation. So, for example, you have borrowing limits on stocks, but you had no such limits on newer financial instruments such as credit default swaps. You had banks and other firms creating mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations, all kinds of things with fancy names, where one of their main purposes was to get around reasonable limits on borrowing, reasonable limits on disclosure. Credit default swaps, for example, unlike other financial instruments, they did not have to trade on regulated exchanges so that people would know where the risk lied. Instead, the risk was just shot throughout the financial system, and nobody knew who would be left holding the bag in a crisis. And the general attitude of regulators is all of these things help manage and quantify risk, so you don't need the old rules to apply to these new markets.
This is the shadow banking world, right?
Yes, exactly.
How you described it, that began emerging in the 80s.
And when you took away these insulations for the economy in the event of financial failure, you could no longer have financial failure.
How did the housing market fit into all of this? If we weren't trying to achieve universal home ownership as a political goal, would the crisis have been averted?
Housing fits into this because it gave the political world, both Republicans and Democrats, a wonderful motive not to see what was happening. For example, housing became just another speculative financial instrument, you know, particularly from 2000 to 2005, where people thought, just as they had a few years earlier with the tech bubble, they could get rich just by buying a house and waiting a few years, and suddenly they had doubled their money and they were considered financial geniuses. The problem is that the government did not recognize that this was just another speculative investment. It needed the same rules to protect the economy against speculative investment that all financial markets have. And this brings us back to the borrowing limits on stocks. If we had had a requirement even that people had to put a 10% down payment, a 20% down payment, the housing market would never have distended the bubble that it did, because people would not have had the cash to keep up with the bubble. Once house prices started to reach 400, 500,000 in some markets, people would not have had $100,000 to put down, and prices would have been dampened by this lack of demand. So very simple rules would have meant that we may have had a bubble, but it would not have been as bad as it became. And when the bubble burst, there would not have been all of this unpaid debt, which is really what killed the banks.
What happened starting in late 2008, or maybe even a little earlier in 2008, what caused this whole thing to finally blow up in the way it did?
Essentially, all of these smart people at the banks, at the investment banks, at other financial firms such as AIG, the insurance giants, and the government regulators started to realize that all of the smart assumptions they had made, this idea that they could measure and manage away all risk, thus making debt virtually riskless and allowing the banks to take on record amounts of debt, allowing consumers to take on record amounts of debt, that all of these assumptions were wrong. And the problem is every assumption that they made had yet another layer of debt on top of it. So when the assumptions started to collapse, these towers of debt started to collapse. And then people started to realize, we don't have any of the rules in place to protect the economy once these assumptions go wrong. We started to have the same type of panic that we saw in the 1930s, where people didn't pull their money out of the banks because they knew that they had this deposit insurance, but investors all over the world started pulling their money out of companies like Lehman Brothers, like Bear Stearns, and these companies could no longer provide credit to the economy. And so that's how a financial crisis caused by lack of insulation for the economy, it turns into an economic crisis where suddenly no one can lend and borrow, even if there are good prospects for that, and you have hundreds of thousands of job losses a month, almost in the blink of an eye.
Could the government have avoided the crisis by, say, bailing out Lehman Brothers instead of letting it fail? Now, many people on Wall Street say that the real problem was that Lehman had all of these credit default swap agreements held with thousands and thousands of other banks and partners, and that those agreements wouldn't be repaid. And so all the government had to do was guarantee the payments, and the financial industry would not have melted down. We wouldn't have had the credit freeze, and the massive global recession that we've experienced would have been avoided.
Well, this is the ultimate parlor game of the credit crisis. You know, could the government have stopped this if it bailed out Lehman, if it didn't bail out Bear Stearns, if it did something different with its $180 billion bailout of AIG? But the problem is, by the time we got to the point of the bailouts, it was too late to stop this crisis. It was foreordained starting in 2005 when these banks and other firms started building up these massive towers of debt under the assumption that nothing could go wrong and without any reasonable regulations to protect the economy from these assumptions if they did go wrong. And, you know, going to the credit default swap agreements, yes, that was the immediate cause of some of this panic that we saw in September, October 2008. But Lehman would not have been able to make all of these agreements with all of these thousands of counterparties if the government had said, yeah, you can innovate all you want, this is wonderful, but you've got to trade these things on exchanges so people know where the risk lies. And you can't make hundreds of billions of dollars worth of potential promises, which is a form of borrowing, without putting some money down. You know, you wouldn't have had AIG make $500 billion worth of promises without, they would have had to put $100 billion perhaps down. And this would have allowed them to take risk, but not so much that it blew up the entire economy.
So, looking forward, and the Obama administration, just as the Bush administration, is wrestling with all of these problems, what do we need to do to fix the financial industry and establish a kind of freer market? After all, we can't predict where the next crisis is going to come from, so, you know, how are we going to prevent it?
Exactly. And the fact that we should know that we can't know where the next crisis is coming, this should direct what kind of regulations we put in place. You know, a lot of people are trying to fight the last war and saying, well, mortgage securities blew up the economy, so we need better rules for mortgage securities, or we need better rules for credit default swaps. But what we really need is reasonable, consistent limits on borrowing anything that looks like option security, like a credit default swap, needs the same consistent limits on borrowing that all such securities have. Anything that looks like a speculative investment needs the same kind of limits on borrowing that the stock market has. And therefore, no matter where the next crisis is coming from, at least we have those limits to somewhat protect the economy from the effects of that crisis. You know, we can't prevent markets from getting ahead of themselves. Sometimes we can't prevent excess on the upside or the downside, but we can protect the economy from the worst effects of that excess. And that is how, in the end, we get to the most important part, which is allowing the market to discipline itself. If these financial firms and their lenders know that risk is so spread out the system that we'll never have failure, they have no incentive to discipline themselves and each other, and that it just sows the seeds for the next crisis.
What about people who describe what happened as a black swan, to use the language that Nassim Taleb has made famous, a once-in-a-hundred-year event, once-in-a-thousand-year event that nobody could have anticipated, and inconceivable that it could happen again anytime soon, so really we don't need to fix anything. Why not just let things proceed as they are?
Right, and there's a certain seductiveness to this idea that nobody could see this coming and that it's just a nightmare that we're finally waking up from and we can just go on as usual. But if you look to the past 25 years of history, ever since we did our first bailout, we've had another bailout episode roughly every half decade or so, and each one gets worse than the last one because these financial firms, they learn better how to game this government guarantee, and they are doing what companies do, which is make as much profits as they can under whatever regulatory system that they live under. But the problem is this system has just set up all of the wrong incentives, and the next time the crisis will be even worse.
Well, certainly in the mainstream press, the focus has been on criminal prosecutions, that there's been all sorts of greed and evil going on. Are criminal prosecutions part of the answer here? And wasn't it just the case that you did have a lot of financial figures who were just greedy and corrupt?
Well, certainly, you know, in every crisis, you find some people who did commit crimes. And of course, we should prosecute financial crimes. But the problem that the government has made, and this is something that has also taken place over, you know, more than 20 years, is they see every financial crisis as a crime, when most of the time you have rational people, not criminals, not greedier than anybody else, who are just acting for their business in an irrational regulatory environment. So, for example, when we put Michael Milken away back in the 80s for, you know, supposed crimes, we failed to see that the real problem was a system that was starting to allow the creation of far too much debt through many innovations that were good for the economy. They just need reasonable regulations to rein them in and protect the economy from their excesses. Instead, we saw these things as crimes, and we said, we're just going to put the bad guys in jail, and the rest of us are protected. So we don't need to worry about the more boring side of how do we fix civil regulations so you can have financial innovation without an economic blow-up.
How would you grade the Obama administration's approach? Certainly financial reform is being discussed now. Are the administration and Congress on the right path here?
No, they're doing exactly the wrong thing, in fact. They seem to have learned the opposite lesson from 25 years worth of modern history and then the Great Depression history before that. What Congress and the White House are trying to do is create a systemic risk regulator, and this regulator would identify all systemic risks to the economy in advance and then try to prevent it from happening. Now, we know from experience that it is impossible to identify the most catastrophic risks in advance. You know, for example, 5 years ago, if we had had this systemic risk regulator, it would have said that these mortgage-backed securities, all of these AAA-rated financial instruments were perfectly safe, that there was no systemic risk. We need the humility to say we can't identify systemic risk, and therefore we need these consistent limits on borrowing, these consistent requirements to trade financial instruments publicly, so that when the unexpected happens, we have some protections for the economy. And this is not what they are doing, because this is not what the financial industry wants.
But what happens if we don't get this right? What's the future?
Well, we're running out of room for error in the economy, in sticking to our system that does not work, that does not allow for marketplace discipline. You know, every time we've had one of these bailouts, the government has managed to handle it, although this time for a while, it was certainly a touch and go there for a while. But the problem is, the next time one of these blow-ups happens, the government may not have the fiscal resources to bail out these financial firms. You see what happened in Iceland, where the banks took on so much risk that they overwhelmed the government's ability to bail out the banks. And this could happen here. It may not happen soon, but it's in some ways it's a mathematical certainty that it will happen unless we prevent these financial firms from relying on an implicit guarantee. And what does that mean for the economy? These financial firms can compete unfairly against startup firms, against entrepreneurial firms, and they crowd out the investment that the economy needs to heal and to be globally competitive. And at the same time, we're creating tremendous federal deficits. We're borrowing from foreign creditors. We're putting that money in these unreformed financial firms. We're not building the roads, the bridges, everything else that the economy needs to grow the private sector. And yes, it's true, we cannot avoid putting money into this financial sector, but we have to make sure that we learn our lesson so this doesn't happen again.
Thank you very much, Nicole. Again, Nicole's book is called After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street and Washington, and it is out from Encounter Books November 30th, right in time for Christmas. It's a spectacular book, as clear as anything you'll find out there on the financial crisis and what to do about it. Thanks again, Nicole.
Thank you, Brian.